Welcome to the first 21st Century Education webcast from Alex Ragone and Arvin Grover, broadcasted on the EdTech Talk channel of the Word World Bridges Network.
There you go.
By the fourth or fifth time I do that, it'll work.
There you go.
Hi, Arvin.
Hey, Alex.
How's it going?
Going well. The last day of school for teachers was yesterday, so I can breathe a little easy today.
That's a beautiful thing. I have teachers outside my door right now, unpacking boxes that just came in. They're picking up their laptops for the summer training.
Oh, exciting.
So if you hear boxes being unpacked, you know what's going on.
And maybe some screams of happiness, huh?
Yeah. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Or screams of dread.
Mm.
One guy's trying to get Palm Desktop installed
Uh-oh.
On his machine. So there might be some screams of dread.
That's usually a tearjerker.
So, Arvin, we've graduated.
We have.
And I think what we want to do for our first webcast is spend a few minutes introducing ourselves to our new listeners. So this is our first EdTech Talk channel broadcast.
Yeah.
So, Arvind.
Should I lead us off?
Tell us about, can you go first?
Yeah, please.
Okay? That'd be great.
As Alex said, my name's Arvind Grover. I am the Director of Technology of the Hewitt School in New York City, which is a K-12 girls' school, and happens to be a longtime laptop school since 97. And we're laptops 1-to-1 in grades 8 through 12, and we're a K-12 school, though, and we pretty much use laptops with all the kids from grades K through 12. And I'm in a school that's a pretty exciting place to be because they're really trying to push the boundaries of how technology works, specifically for young women and young girls, and to see how we can change some of the paradigms that are out there for these women who haven't had exposure in the past to the types of technology that are available now. And I also am a blogger. I've been blogging for over a year now, I'd say, and longer than that, but not so well before the year, at 21apples.org. And Alex and I have actually work very close to each other, couple miles, but we mainly know each other from the blogosphere and now from our radio show that we've been doing for the past month and a half. So I think that's enough about me, Alex. You want to jump in?
You got it. So this is webcast number 6, and when Arvin and I started this out at webcast number 1, we thought, what do we want to talk about? And so we talked about a little bit about 21st century learning. I guess that's the theme of both of our blogs and what we're really interested in. And so I'm the director of technology at an all-boys school called Collegiate School on the west side of Manhattan. And I've been here for 5 years. And it's been a fun ride. It's been very interesting. I think I've become much more of a curriculum person over the last 5 years. Hey, guys, whoever's typing, can you mute your mic?
Not me.
Sorry about that.
Chris. No problem at all. Thanks, Chris. So I've been doing this for about 5 years here. I was a tech director at another school for 3 years before this. And what I'm really interested in right now is how we teach students in 21st century computer-enabled environments, as well as personal environments. I think it's important to have both computer and real world experiences, but I'm really excited about the learning I've been doing over the last year, and I think that I want to help other people see that and help students see that and scaffold their learning. I think the thing about students that everybody talks about is how computer savvy they are, and my perspective is that it's really important for us to teach them how to use those tools most appropriately. So in terms of research and organization, Arvin and I have been talking a lot about organization lately.
Yeah.
And just making them better students and lifelong learners with ethical and values and global values. So they're thinking about the whole world as they make their decisions. That's a little big picture.
Yeah.
But I blog at learningblog.org. It's got a dash learning-blog.org. And I put some stuff up there on information literacy lately and MySpace statistics and lies. And I've just had a great time doing this, and the webcast has been a lot of fun, and I look forward to taking this journey as far as we can go, Arvin.
Yeah, Alex approached me with this idea of the webcast, and one thing Alex and I are always trying to figure out is will we have enough time to do all the things we were dreaming up of doing? And I was kind of nervous
Never.
About the webcast, especially thinking like, oh, I'm not going to have time to do this. But I think I've done a pretty good job and of, you know, fitting it in and making it a priority. And it's been really rewarding just getting to talk to people who are listening on the web and seeing that people actually are thinking about the same things and hearing back what they have to say.
Yeah, it's definitely great. The chat room, since we are at a good break point, I believe.
Yeah.
If you want to get involved in this conversation and ask questions, you can go to www.edtechtalk.com/chat to join in the chat. And I am happy to introduce our first guest on edtechtalk.com, Chris Lehman, the principal of Science Learning Academy. Hi, Chris.
Leadership, but close enough.
Leadership,
hello, hello.
I'm sorry.
Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia.
One of the things is that everybody says that. Like, I think clearly the problem is that the school was named wrong, because everybody from the head of the Franklin Institute board to the chief academic officer of the School District of Philadelphia has at one time or another made that mistake. So clearly we've just given the school the wrong name.
So I feel better. Sorry about that. Our webcast name is a little long.
Oh, yeah.
And Jeff Lebo has been calling us the 21st Century Learner webcast, which isn't a bad idea either. So I think eventually it'll just be the Alex and Arvind show.
Yeah.
There you go.
Brian Lehrer has a great story from NPR, WNYC. They went through all these different new names when they first started broadcasting, and they ended up with the Brian Lehrer Show.
Well, I was hoping that our school could pick up the nickname of Einstein High. I think that'd be a lot of fun, but so far we haven't had any takers on that. So, I think it, to me, it's one of those, the neat thing about the name is actually that it's not just, you know, the important thing is that it's not just a science school, that we have, you know, phenomenal humanities programs and all the rest of it, but we really do view sort of the learning of the hands-on inquiry-based learning of science as leading the way sort of with the rest of the curriculum as well. So it actually ends up being a somewhat apt name, I suppose.
Yeah,
I really like the name. It's a great name. So, Chris, can you tell us how this thing started? You were a tech director at a school on the east side, right, in New York?
Actually, on the west side, right on 61st Street.
Oh, the
Beacon School, which is this wonderful progressive public high school. And still a great place for people to go check out. And beaconschool.org is the website if you want to see what a phenomenal public school website can look like. I'm from the Philadelphia area, originally grew up in and out of Philadelphia, went to college in Philly, and have sort of always watched what was going on here in terms of school reform, for the time that it might make sense to come home. And for the longest time, new school reform and the small school movement here in Philly meant charter schools. And while I think there's a lot of great work being done in the charter school movement, it wasn't where I wanted to spend my personal energies. I'm still a big believer in the whole idea that if districts can get it done right, can change, that we can still see a lot of great things happen within the sort of large school district model. So about a year and a half ago, a little bit more now almost, Philly announced that they were starting these new small schools. And I just started calling anybody that I still knew in Philadelphia. Got the opportunity to talk to Carol Parson in here at the Franklin Institute about the idea that they were sort of in conversations with the district about starting a school, and, you know, sort of came down and pitched my ideas and started talking to as many people as I could, and I think that made it happen such that when the position was posted, I really had a strong sense of what I thought the school, what the partnership between the Franklin Institute and the school district could mean. And a year and a half later, we're 80 days from school opening. You know, and that's the sort of short version of it. But yeah, I mean, it was just really a case of the district looking at the small school movement and me looking at coming back to Philadelphia and sort of taking everything that I'd learned in the small schools movement in New York City, which is, you know, one of the great hotbeds in this country for small progressive schools, and, you know, and coming back and trying to apply it here.
So it seems like you have a couple of different goals. I mean, you're talking about science as a focus, talking about leadership, small schools, and also working with the Franklin Institute, so working with, you know, an external organization.
Yeah.
How do you fit all those pieces together?
I don't sleep. Well, I think a lot of it is making sure that the pieces are working towards the same goal. And that, fortunately, is pretty easy working with this, with the Franklin Institute. You know, the Franklin Institute has been about as involved and active a partner as you could want. The folks here very much believe in reforming education. They think that a lot of the lessons learned in the world of informal education, in museum education, could have some interesting ramifications in the world of formal school-based education. So we're interested in trying that out. They also are looking at what it will mean to have eventually 500 kids who view this institution as part of their campus and how that may reinvigorate them for the 21st century. So it's really, what's nice is, and I think that anytime schools look to get into partnerships, you know, we use that word a lot when we talk about schools. Schools need partners and da-da-da-da. And too often that means one of two, I think, in the end, unhealthy things. One is schools have their hands out and just ask for stuff. And I'm all for that and certainly have done that, but it's limiting at the end. Or two, a corporation, an institution, or what have you, a foundation, says, we've got this wonderful program in here. If you implement it exactly the way that we tell you to, you can do it. Neither of those, I think, are long-term sustainable models. I think that when we look at partnerships in the school, business, school, cultural institution, what have you, communities, we need to say, how does this partnership enrich both partners? And I think that we look at what the kids are going to get out of having this partnership with the Franklin Institute, and I can get into some of the sort of how that affects kids' lives, you know, in their life at the school, as really enriching the program of SLA, but we also see it as being a huge benefit for the Franklin Institute to have these kids who are going to really cast a critical eye on the way the Franklin Institute works. So it's a true partnership, which I think is exciting.
That's amazing to hear about.
Thanks.
Partnerships and appropriate relationships. There's a lot of research, actually, on I read an ASCD book this fall on leadership, and there's a lot of research on taking models, you know, like the tech high school in California, and tweaking them, and how you have to put your own imprint on them to make them effective.
Yeah.
So I think you're right on there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this whole sort of replication thing that we see everywhere, that, you know, the hope is that some school somewhere is going to create the black box that we can then just export everywhere, is, to me, fool's gold. You know, we are a research and development school for the district, in that folks here are really very much interested in what we're doing, watching what we're doing, and interested in taking the lessons we learn and applying them to other schools in the district. But what I am most interested in is not sort of the answers we come up with, but rather the questions we ask. And I think that the best thing that this district can learn from what we're doing is sort of getting other groups of teachers and administrators together to ask these questions and come up with their own answers. I'd love to take a second and address Lori Bartel's question, if that's okay. Or Lori Bartel.
Sure.
Yeah, Bartel. Her question, for those folks not in the chat, is we're curious how we use the focus on science to include the humanities. You know, in a moment of pure confessional here, I'm an English teacher by background. I also was a tech coordinator and spent 10 years involved in educational technology in pretty immersive levels at Beacon. But the classes I taught primarily more than any others were my English classes. So it's a great question. And in my first conversation with the Franklin Institute folks before the job was ever even sort of officially out there was, what the heck's an English teacher doing wanting to run a science high school? And it's a fair question. I think what's amazing about the Franklin Institute and about science learning in general is that it is the most logical place to start inquiry and project-based learning. So what we're doing is taking what I think are the best ethos of scientific learning, the idea of hands-on, project-based, experimental, peer-reviewed learning, and applying that across all disciplines. So, you know, the question we always get asked is, you know, well, does this mean you're going to be reading science fiction in English, da-da-da-da, how much is the actual science content going to be driving curriculum? And the answer is it's much more about science learning pedagogy. Now, that being said, when we developed our essential questions, we developed our science curriculum, and what we decided we were going to do, we got out there and we talked to a lot of scientists, and what we heard from them was that the barriers between the sort of way we look at science in high schools with biology and then chemistry and then physics or physics first or what have you and all this stuff, those walls break down when you get into the real world. It's not like a scientist says, ooh, now I'm studying biology, now I'm studying chemistry, and never the twain shall meet. So we created an integrated biology chemistry, which, you know, even though it's a little bit of a misnomer, we just call it biochemistry class. And what we did is, as we sort of created the scope and sequence of it, we looked to go from the microsystems to the macrosystems. And then we said, well, what does it mean to look at going from micro to macro across the disciplines? And that led us to our essential questions. We said that, well, the micro level of society is the individual. And our ninth grade essential questions are, who am I? What influences my identity, and how do I interact with the world? And those essential questions that we study across the disciplines have their foundation in this notion of the micro to macro movement of science. So, but you can see certainly in an English classroom or a history classroom where those questions have powerful resonance. So what we did is we said, you know, it's about sort of creating that unified curriculum where the kids are looking at these questions through the different lenses of the different disciplines. And again, we think that the way in which they learn, the projects they create, the way that they'll be assessed, has very much its roots in scientific learning. If that answers your question.
Yeah, it seems there's a lot in there. I think one of the big points of confusion for people when you're talking about, especially developing new curriculum for schools, is this idea of developing the content versus developing,
right,
like you were talking about, starting with essential questions. Because I think people say, well, we want to see your curriculum. Like, what are you teaching? Like, cell division? Are you teaching this? Like, and there's this focus on the skills and the actual content that they're learning rather than going out big picture and realizing that there's, you know, innumerable ways to cross over curriculum that's inquiry-based. You know, if you start
that's
an
right.
inquiry and not biology, it's much different.
That's right. And you still obviously have to get to the content. I mean, there's no question about that. And
right.
You know, one of the things that I can do, and I'll actually do it at the end of this chat, is I'll repost on my blog, practicaltheory.org, what we gave out, the PDF of what we gave out at Family Night, which is a 30-page overview, I guess, if you can call 30 pages an overview, of our curriculum and how we sort of see a lot of these things playing out in the different disciplines. And hopefully for folks listening in, that'll give you a sense of sort of a richer sense of what it is I'm talking about here.
I think that would be a great resource for people.
I started reading it last night, Chris. I got about halfway done, and it was very, very interesting.
Well, thank you.
I think what's most interesting is the big picture questions directing everything, but the fact that you have to concentrate on skills and the basics as well at the same time, and that blend.
Yeah, and I think that I mean the funny thing is I just don't think it's that hard to do that. I shouldn't say that. It's not that it's easy, but I think it just makes sense. You know, I mean, and some of it is driven by the understanding by design model of curriculum development, which says you have to have your end in mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, work backwards. And, you know, and so there's sort of two, you know, we're sort of pushing in two directions. One is inquiry-based, which is sort of question and forward, and then the other is UBD, which is end and backward. And the hope is, I think, to meet in the middle somewhere. For us, end and backward is this notion of that we're really trying to move the kids from what essentially will be in the ninth grade, a lot of very guided, structured inquiry, where, you know, they really are being led to the questions that they need to ask in a lot of ways, and also not only led to the questions, but really handed the skills they needed and worked with to get the skills that they needed to be able to ask those questions and answer them in powerful ways. To the notion of our capstone experience in the senior year, where the questions at the last and the way in which they'll go about it will be much more open inquiry. Again, there'll be a structure, there'll be a lot of benchmarks the kids have to hit even in their senior year to say, like, okay, now I've done my research, now I've got my experimental design, now I've done my experimentation, you know, here are all the benchmarks. But the questions that they ask and the ways in which they design their answers will be much more open-ended than it will be, say, in a ninth grade biochemistry or a ninth grade history class.
Can you just mention what grades your school is, Chris?
We're a high school. We're starting next year with just a ninth grade.
Okay.
So we're starting with what I imagine by September will be 120 ninth graders. We have 110 of them identified now. We've left 10 spots open for people who might be moving to the district.
Okay.
Those kids really are going to help us design the school. I mean, it's quite a challenge to be a founding student. It's almost as big a challenge to be a founding student as it is to be a founding teacher or founding principal. And, you know, they get to be the guinea pigs. And something that is true of hopefully every kid that we get in, no matter how long the school's around, which is that we kind of dare kids. We say, you know, if you're coming here, the question we're going to ask you is not only how do you think this school is going to change who you are, but how is who you are going to change who we are? And so the question we put up there to the freshmen and to kids who are interested in coming is, why will SLA be a better school because you walked our halls for 4 years? And if you're not prepared to answer that question, and not with necessary answers, but if you're not excited by the idea that you will be asked that question, this might not be the school that you want to go to. We want kids who see this as who see the notion of transformation as a two-way street. And we see that of our teachers, too. Our teachers have got to be willing to be changed by the kids if we expect the kids to be changed by us.
How does it work? I mean, I guess this is a charter school question.
This is not a charter school.
Okay, so it's a public school.
Yes.
Okay, great. Sorry.
But your question might still be apt.
How does admissions work?
Great question. We are what is classified as, in Philadelphia, a special admissions school that oftentimes gets called a magnet school. We want to sort of play with what that means. I don't think at the end of the day, magnet, I mean, it's fine for some schools, not for us, I guess, that... I'm not interested in magnet meaning the highest test scores and highest grades. That's less interesting to me. For me, it's about magnet really meaning mutual attraction. So, for example, next year when we have a faculty and students to be able to pull this off, to get into SLA, we will look at grades and test scores and council recommendation, but a significant portion of students coming in, their admission process will be coming to us for an interview where they present a project that they believe is a good representation of who they are as a student, and they present it to one teacher and one current SLA student, and that rubric graded project and interview will have carry as much weight as any of the other pieces of admissions. So, and we think that that'll give us a richer picture of who these kids are, what kids are excited about the notion of project-based learning, and what kids we think will really thrive in our model. And that's exciting to us. And I think that allows us to cast a much wider net than just looking at grades and test scores would.
Now, with your project-based approach, Chris, are you looking to are you going to be doing a lot of interdisciplinary work? How do you see that working?
I guess on some level, ask me in a couple of months when we're in the middle of it. But yeah, I think that interdisciplinary work is one of those interesting things because sometimes teachers think it means that while you're studying the Civil War in history, you're reading Civil War novels in English. And right. To me, that's the sort of lowest level of interdisciplinarity. To me, I think those essential questions are a higher level when you have kids sort of asking, who am I across disciplines? So as they're studying genetics, they're reading Hamlet, and sort of asking those powerful questions of, why am I the way I am genetically, physically, what have you, and how do I, how am I the way that I am metaphysically? And I think that then when you're creating projects across classes, you're doing some incredible things. Kids will be what we call streamed. So they will take English, history, and science as a cohort. That will allow the teachers to work in interdisciplinary fashion, so they'll be able to design projects that are assigned across multiple classes and things like that to enable that kind of project-based learning that is interdisciplinary. So yes, I think that there will be interdisciplinary learning. I think, again, the projects will be, but also the questions they ask, the way the lenses by which they're sort of studying the material will be, and I think that that actually is a pretty, that's some higher-order stuff that we're hoping to have go on. In Philadelphia, in most high schools, in fact, just about all of them, kids have to take quarterly online benchmark exams to measure their learning. Yeah, and there's a unified curriculum, and it's, scope and sequence and what have you. We have been given the charge, and it's of reinvigorating and reimagining the core curriculum. And one of the pieces of that is that we are developing the rubrics that we will use in each of the subjects to assess quarterly benchmark projects. And those projects will be, assessed on a rubric so parents can see where our teachers think that the kids are at any point in time in their learning, what strengths they have, what areas they need improvement on, what have you. And there are a lot of people who are very excited to watch how we do that. That's another area where the projects really take on added import for us. And it really is about revaluing and valuing the work of the classroom, that the teachers who are working on with the kids and creating these projects and creating the rubrics by which the projects are graded are able to really give a strong assessment of where kids are in any, at any point along the way.
That type of feedback and assessment is really critical to learning, and I think something that we miss a lot of times, especially, I would say, in teaching in a small classroom, it allows us a lot more flexibility than, say, 30 kids.
Yep.
What kind of class sizes are you guys going to have?
Much more around 30 kids. Next year will be small because we are getting an extra staffing allocation to get off the ground, which was, I think, really wonderful for the district to provide. But we are a public school, and we are going to have bigger classrooms. The contractual mandate or the contractual limit here in Philadelphia is 33. We're going to do everything we can to keep it under 30. The other thing that we're going to try and do long term, which is doable but difficult, is teachers here teach 5 plus a homeroom, and the homeroom really is not much more than that. And what we're actually going to try and do is have teachers teach 4 plus advisory, advisory being more of a prep than a homeroom would be. An advisory will also be a 4-year program where the kids stay together for all 4 years. To do that, it will keep our class sizes closer to 30, but it will keep our teaching load down a little bit. So we want teachers seeing 120 kids on their roster plus their advisory as opposed to 150, and hopefully that keeps us away from a breaking point of this kind of project-based learning. And then we're gonna do some innovative things around grant funding and endowments and such to try and get extra adults in the building to keep our class size down, and also use some innovative programs that we're talking about with Drexel's School of Education to even if our classes are bigger than we'd like, to try and keep the adult-to-student ratio as low as we can.
Yeah. So maybe we should talk a little bit about faculty. And
sure.
You talked a little about what your admissions process for students is, but how do you get faculty who you feel are going to be comfortable and successful in your model?
Well, number one, there are at this point a number of progressive networks out there, from Mike Klonsky's Small Schools Yahoo Group to the Essential Schools Job Board to Idealist. There are a lot of places where progressive educators are looking for job postings. So one is we use that. Most of those services are free, so it's taking advantage of that. It doesn't hurt. Interestingly enough, that I'm a blogger, and I was able to post our job announcements on my blog and got some people applying from that, which was fun, freaky but fun. The other thing is we wrote a job description that was, when we sort of showed it around, and we didn't do any of this stuff in isolation. There's a lot of people who are excited about this school and are invested in seeing us succeed, not just here in Philadelphia, but in the larger educational community, who sort of looked at everything and said, yeah, this is good or not. And a lot of things went through a lot of revisions. But the job posting we put out there, I think, attracted a lot of the right people. It was one of those things that, we showed it to a longtime administrator, and the first thing they said was, you know who you're looking for. And they said, this is going to scare off a lot of people. And honestly, my answer to that is great. It scared off a lot of people, but the people who I think were excited by the model and excited by this kind of teaching read that and went, oh my God, this is the place I have to work. And that was that was step one. Step two is committing to a mountain of interviews, and we did for the 11 positions that we hired, 8 regular ed teachers, 1 special ed, 1 counselor, 1 librarian. We did closing in on 50 interviews, first interviews, and then a number of second interviews. And we had a really rigorous group of questions that we asked. I think we had about 20 questions, and the interviews took well over an hour each. And the questions were really targeted to elicit the strengths of the teachers. And it's funny because for the teachers that we ended up hiring, I think that they thought it wasn't an easy interview, but the questions made a lot of sense. And there was never a question of why we would ask a certain question. For people we didn't end up hiring, some of those questions really, really tripped them up. And it was interesting to see that work. For someone who was really excited about a project-based environment or excited about the notion of being in a school where kids have a fair amount of say in their education, the questions we asked were wonderful sort of entries to conversation to folks who knew that we were affiliated with the science school and knew we were special admissions and what have you. I think that they heard us talking about this stuff and kind of were turned off by it or didn't know how to answer it, which was great. I think we have a world-class faculty. I'm really excited about the folks we hired. They're amazing, and they've been working their butts off while they've been teaching in other schools for the last few months to get us moving and going. And I just think they bring a whole lot to the table. And I'll be honest, one of the most exciting things for me about this has been sort of, spending the first 6 or 7 months of the planning year sort of carrying the vision along with, the folks at the Franklin Institute, the folks at the district, but, being the sort of one staff member of the Science Leadership Academy, and then bringing the teachers on board and seeing them take the vision, make the vision their own, and then push it further so that we'll be ready to open just spectacularly in September has been, I think, so far the most gratifying piece of all this.
Hey, I've been reading along with your blog and seeing the excitement there. Can you tell us a little bit about that process, Chris? How you guys have been developing
Sure.
the curriculum? Because
Sure.
I think that's really exciting. It kind of pulls in the tech piece, I think.
Which we haven't mentioned at all yet. So.
But that's the most beautiful part of this conversation so far, in my mind at least.
Well, sure. I mean, the challenge obviously is that we're all in different places and all finishing up our school years. And so we are a 21st century school, and our course management software that we're going to use for our kids is Moodle, which, if you don't know, is moodle.org. And it is essentially an open source version of WebCT or Blackboard. It's a wonderful course management software. And it does tons of things, and I think we've only scratched the surface of what it can do. And we had to learn the tool together. And what better way to learn the tool than to use the tool authentically? So we created a Moodle class, quote-unquote, as our planning workshop. And we've been using the forums, using the chats, using peer review, all sorts of the functionality of Moodle to plan the school, you know, right down to having Monday evening 8:30 staff meetings every week online. And that's been amazing. And I think a lot of folks were like, oh, what do you mean you're planning online? And then we gave them accounts, let them poke in on what we were doing, and they were sort of blown away by it. It's funny, before the chat today, I was down at the school district central office, and one of the curriculum and instruction folks who have the ability to, you know, we gave them accounts so they could watch our planning process because we really want to be transparent with this. You know, she saw me in the elevator and she made just some sort of comment about, oh, that was a great comment you had on, you know, on the, what was it? I don't even remember what thread, one of the threads. And, you know, it took me a second. I was like, oh, that's right, you're reading this too. But it's, you know, they've really sort of been amazed as the school district is looking for different ways to roll out staff development for a city that's as big as Philadelphia. I think they're watching what we're doing and watching the development work that we're doing and going, wow, this is something that, you know, hopefully they can use as well. And so hopefully, again, looking at where SLA can be research and development for the district, I think we're giving them a powerful model of what school planning can look like and staff development can look like, that when you can't get everybody in the same place. Or even if you can, you know, there's something powerful about having the document repository. I mean, all of the things. I mean, we're going to see what it looks like when everybody's in the same place and can then go home and extend the day. I mean, the goal with Moodle when our kids are using it is going to be obviously to break down the walls of the school. We want learning to be 24/7, 365, not merely sort of, okay, if it's 10:30 on Tuesday, I must be in English. And Moodle's a wonderful way to do that. And Arvind, you and I should talk more about how you're using it, and because we are, you know, we're literally now getting to the point where we're starting to be ready to design our specific class Moodle stuff. So that might be something you and I can talk about at another
point. Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of exciting stuff going on with Moodle these days in the U.S. I think the U.S. has been a little behind in picking it up. Some other countries have really taken off with it. But there is a Moodle Moot going on up in near Boston this summer coming up. I'll post a link to that.
Oh, cool.
Which is a meeting of Moodle users, including Martin Dugiamis, who started Moodle.
I'm just curious if you've started, if the folks at your school have turned the word Moodle into a verb. That's what
I actually noticed. Yeah, we didn't brand it as Moodle. We just gave it a name. We call it Course Web. And so I keep using Moodle, and people are like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I didn't realize like that they don't understand that there's software Moodle. They just think it's, you know, part of our intranet or whatever it is.
That's funny. We quickly started calling it Moodling. And worse, one of our teachers actually noticed that if you took SLA Moodle, you could call it Slamoodling. So we've already come up with some of the dumbest terms you know, possible, and every time I go out and speak about this, you know, it's sort of the classic open source jokes of we're going to give something a silly name. You then try and be very serious at very serious conferences with serious people in suits, and you're talking about Moodling, and you just feel like a moron.
Well, I think that's, you know, part of the draw. Like when I remember giving my students first access to Moodle, and they just went crazy because of like the smiley faces. You know what I mean? And they were willing to be involved in a chat if they could use the smiley faces. And I sort of was like, well, okay, if you're willing to discuss ethics of media technology, I'll let you use the smiley faces.
Exactly. What we found when we built, because we were sort of dyed-in-the-wool do-it-yourselfers at Beacon, we wrote our whole portal ourselves in PHP MySQL.
That.
Yeah, we were nuts. And one of our students who now is actually an alumni who just graduated from Tufts and is going to work for Apple, wrote the forum software that we used. And one of the things we sort of educated kids with was the idea that AOL speak is maybe not appropriate for a school forum. And, you know, there's this sort of, it's funny to watch sort of the forum use mirror the old Usenet use in that every September we sort of had to educate the freshmen on the freshmen on the forums, sort of like every, you know, September, the same thing with all the college kids, you know, posting like
you
idiots.
You have that email that goes out to the whole class and faculty.
Yeah.
And then the thread ensues.
Right.
And the administrative assistant is saying, well, who is sending me email?
Exactly.
Exactly. Every September with fifth grade.
Yeah, exactly. Surya had an interesting question. She said, asks, in what ways will the district be paying attention to what we're doing and how will our ideas be replicated? The first part of your question is sort of yes. You know, our teachers had to be prepared to teach in a fishbowl. Philadelphia is this interesting, unfortunately she just got booted out, but hopefully she's still listening. Philadelphia is this fascinating district in that it is large. I mean, I think it is like the seventh or eighth largest school district in the country. And yet it functions very much as a small district. Coming from New York City, which is four times the size, you didn't necessarily as a school principal have conversations with the chief academic, with the equivalent of the chief academic officer very often. You know, you didn't see these people. But, you know, you go to the high school principal and, you know, you couldn't have meetings where you got all the principals in a room in Philadelphia, in New York City. In Philly, it's a big room, but they do it. And so you see the head of curriculum instruction. You see these people. And so they know what's going on in your school. They know what's going on in many of the schools. But for us specifically, the heads of curriculum instruction for each of the different disciplines are on our planning committee. You know, they're working with us. They read the documents we write. I mean, everything we write goes out to the head of curriculum instruction, the head of high schools, the chief academic officer, the head of development, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're watching what we do very carefully, you know. So it's not like, oh, you got all these exemptions now, you know, goodbye. They're watching what we do. They're reading our, you know, unit plans. They are coming to the school and visiting. We are actually working with, Philadelphia has contracted with an organization called SchoolNet to do their family information system stuff. And that's where a parent can get a login and see how the kids have done on the benchmark exams. And we're working with SchoolNet, for example, to be able to upload PDFs of the rubrics that we create for our online project, you know, for our project-based benchmarking, excuse me. And so not only will the parents be able to see those rubrics, but obviously so will everybody in the district. And then I think, you know, again, because we're sort of creating this research model, we're working with Drexel School of Education, we're working, you know, with folks here to watch what we do and look at what we do and hopefully, again, come up with interesting questions that can at least, again, if not our, I don't necessarily think our answers will be replicated, but I think the questions we come up with and maybe some of the structures that we come up with will be replicated. And, you know, I think that that's a work in progress. I mean, I know that the head of curriculum and instruction, Sil Cannon, is coming to our July planning session and coming to talk to our teachers and listen to them as they talk about their curriculum and what have you. And she's going to be taking that stuff back to her folks and taking that stuff back to larger discussions for the district.
Chris,
does that answer questions for you?
Hopefully. They're a little behind us on the time, so she'll be still listening to you.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So one question I had, Chris, is you used to be a technology coordinator, used to do all this stuff. As a head of school, what are your expectations for faculty? Alex and I last week talked about faculty a lot. Do we expect enough of them? What are your expectations of faculty in terms of technology?
Well, pretty inclusive, you know. I mean, right down to, you know, the first step was you had to be able to, you know, you had to be able to handle Moodle to you know, be involved in planning. And saying I can't do it wasn't an answer. Our kids will be, barring any more sort of budget cuts from the state, our kids are we are going to be hopefully a one-to-one laptop school, which is exciting. And so the kids are going to have the technology. Every class will have a Moodle component to it. And one of the ways we're affording the laptops and one of the ways the district is working with us is we are not giving the kids textbooks. So we're looking at the sort of Empire High School model out in Arizona as one place to look at. And so our teachers are going to have to be very good at really structuring their curriculum using Moodle. And that's going to be the primary sort of document repository for all of our teachers. And they really love the idea that online gradebook. They love the idea of a lot of the features of Moodle. And we're just sort of playing around with wikis now and just sort of, I mean, the hope is that we're ready with Moodle 1.6 and ELG for the blogging and social software and blah, 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 and we're sort of building that portal this summer. But everybody's got to be able to do it. And, you know, teachers are going to post their homework assignments online so parents can get them. Teachers are going to... our teachers are really excited about, you know, the peer review features of Moodle, things like that. Teachers know that they're going to be scanning documents and posting them as PDF files to get more primary source materials into the kids' hands. And every class, you know, will have a wiki, and that'll be a lot of the, you know, we're looking at wiki books and a lot of the other stuff that's going on that's interesting stuff, and teachers are going to have to use it. You know, I think that, you know, and to sort of look at Surya gasping there with no textbooks, we will have textbooks in the classroom. You know, it's not like we're not going to have resources. The books still have usage. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. But, you know, rather than buying 120 copies of, you know, textbook A, we'll buy 15 and keep them in the classroom as a class library to use when necessary. But I think there's, you know, once you move from the idea that, you know, there's this sort of sequential way of learning all of these different things that must be abided by, and the textbook is our Bible, you know, you get into more interesting things. And again, looking at the software that's out there, I mean, there's no reason that every classroom can't create its own wiki that becomes essentially the text.
Yeah, and you lose that inquiry then. If you're, well, we're about out of time on this subject, we got to move on to section 1.3 of the textbook.
Exactly. Or, you know, you also lose, I mean, I think the other thing you lose is something that's happening in the world today is one of the most critical things we can teach kids is becoming critical consumers of information. Mm-hmm. And textbook as Bible, as we've all sort of went through high school that way and you know, back in the crazy hazy days of the 80s and such, for those folks who went to high school in the 80s, you know, and before, you know, moving past that and teaching kids that there's more information out there and there are multiple perspectives and learning how to judge those perspectives and create their own meaning is one of the most powerful things we can do. There's a wonderful book that I loved teaching. And for those English teachers out there, we are still buying novels for every, you know, like that's the one thing the kids will still get is the books to read, you know. Again, this is where my English teacher self comes out, and that is there's still something wonderful about the idea of curling up somewhere and reading a really good book. We'll use some
e-books. And you're the principal.
And I am the principal. You know, but that was also, you know, when we were interviewing English teachers and we talked about the textbookless school, they said, well, you know, textbooks, sure, but, you know, novels? And it was like, don't worry, we're getting novels. Surya, to answer your question, Moodle has built into it wikis as something that you can add right out of the box. So one of the things we're looking at, and we have to learn how to use wikis more powerfully, and it's something that I'm learning now and our teachers are going to learn, is students can write as part of their class, essentially create those digital textbooks as part of Moodle by creating wikis. And it's very easy to set up by the teacher, and it takes a little bit of time to learn sort of wiki languages, but that will be a major piece of it. And again, Moodle as course software is very, very flexible. Plus the kids will be blogging. You asked earlier, will teachers be blogging? I'm not mandating that. I think that that's a personal preference thing. Kids will be blogging, and that'll be very important. Again, I think that it's a powerful thing when you show kids that they can publish to a wider world, and suddenly their classwork is no longer just a communication between them as student and teacher as assessor, but rather a communication with the whole world. I think that what that opens up to kids and the way that they look at their own writing and their own learning and their own process is mind-bogglingly cool, to get on EduSpeak for a moment. But they also will be doing some, you know, so some of their work will be published sort of beyond the portal on their own blogs, and some of it will be sort of a conversation now, not just between one-on-one, but rather classroom conversations with their own wikis and stuff like that, that will be, at least in the beginning, behind the firewall of our portal.
And so you're going to be using Elg to do that student blogging?
That's, I think so. We're looking at Elg. We're looking at B2 Evolution. We're also sort of wondering, you know, I've read that Moodle 1.6 will have blogging software built in.
Yeah.
So we don't have an answer to that yet. We just hired our techie.
All right.
In the last week or two, we were able to work with the district to find someone that we think is going to be great. And he is a recent graduate of college and majored in computer science and information technology. And now our job is to get him up to speed on the open source world. You know, he's a programmer. He can program Java. He can program C++. He knows, you know, all sorts of, you know, database programming.
Great person to have in-house.
Amazing person to have in-house. You know, that was, for me, one of the really scary pieces of this, and what I've been saying to someone, people, was, you know, I had to find the person who would be for SLA what I was for Beacon. Which was the, you know, the geek in the room who was willing to program at 2 o'clock in the morning to make something work. And, you know, because I can't be that person anymore.
Sure.
And that's really tough. You know, it is one of the, you know, we have an amazing depth of faculty to start up. We have an incredible depth of faculty when it comes to our technology infrastructure. We have our librarian is one of the folks who has been using Koha forever. So he's a big open source advocate. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, just, you know, money, you know. And he's an incredibly experienced librarian. He's this incredibly, you know, he's just this wonderful, kind, caring man who also happens to be a big Linux and open source advocate. Like, you know, and a phenomenal librarian in his own right. I mean, you know, people found out that we got him, and he did come from inside the district. He left a school to come to us, and people jaw sort of dropped when he found out he was transferring. But for him, I think the excitement is what he's been doing in open source and Koha and what have you been sort of held into just the library. And at the school he was at, it wasn't sort of built out into the broader community. I think he looks at the idea of Moodle and, you know, open source education and a school that where that pedagogy is writ large as a dream for him to come and get to start, as well as building a library from scratch. So, you know, we've got him, and then we have this woman, Marcy, who is both an artist and a technologist and sort of brings a real powerful aesthetic view to the way the kids use technology. And then we have Frankie, who's our techie. And, you know, the really only restrictions we're putting on anybody is dream, you know, is, you know, how big you can dream and how hard you can work. And, you know, that's fun stuff. And for me, knowing that we have that team in place means that I feel very good about sort of being able to set a direction and work with them to suggest ideas and to bring stuff to bear, you know, and all the stuff that I've learned over the last 10 years, but then also to say to them, you know, you got to make this your own vision and you got to implement it as well, and that's exciting. I did say to all of them when, you know, at various points when in the interview process, or when we, I guess, made them the offer, is that I feel badly for all of them, because it is going to take every ounce of self-restraint that I have not to backseat drive on this stuff. And poor Frankie, who's wonderful, I'm sure there's going to be times when I'm sort of looking over his shoulder as he codes, going, no, let's make it look this way, or, you know. And that's my own sort of natural exuberance that will have to be sort of duct taped to the chair to prevent me from doing that. And but yeah, I mean, and I think they're excited to have, I mean, you know, all kidding aside, I think they're pretty excited to have a principal who wants that vision as well. I think that, you know, as much as I'm going to be a pain in the neck, and I freely admit it, hopefully it's going to be in the best possible sense that they have an administrator who believes in 21st century learning.
I have a feeling, Chris, that some other things are going to keep you too busy to get your head poking in the code.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I agree, but that's what, you know, SSH and 2:30 in the morning is meant for.
Don't give the principal emails. Access to the server.
No admin access.
Exactly.
That's right.
I know from your emails, Chris, that it's 11:30, 12 most of the time when you're responding to mine, so
yeah,
you're just starting to work then.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun. You know, the truly crazy personal piece of all of this is that, in addition to, is, you know, I have two major births happening in September. One is the birth of SLA, but my wife is due with our second child on the first day of school.
Oh, my gosh. On
the first day.
So, yeah, it's what you call really smart planning. Who knew? And, so, you know, I figure there'll be a lot of emails sent around the sort of 2:30 at night, you know, night feeding, where I'm, you know, he's in one, you know, the baby's in one arm, and you know, I'm typing, you know, with the other arm. Oh my gosh, lots of stuff that people are asking on the chat. Can I define 21st century learning in one sentence? I can't define anything in one sentence. I don't know if you've caught that from. I'm the most verbose human being that they ever existed.
I think the post, can I bug in?
Please.
For a second, Chris? Your post that you put up a few weeks ago in response to Will Richardson's talking to superintendents sums it up in a page, and I think it's a really amazing post. When I want to get pumped up about education, I read that post.
Oh, wow. Cool.
I think Arvind and I linked it to our last show, talking about teacher and administrator accountability. Because I think one of the things that we see that's lacking in current education is forward thinking. And, you know, we're talking about testing kids, standards, but what's the goal of what we're doing?
Right.
And I think you guys have done that beautifully.
Well, thank you. You know, the hard part, of course, is that we haven't done anything yet. You know, we've proven that we can talk about a school really well. We've proven that we can write really well.
Right.
You know, for me, it's all about September and forward. You know, as much as, you know, I mean, if you were to look at my desk and if you were to look at the whiteboard behind my desk of all of the notes of the stuff that I got to do in the next few weeks, you would be sort of thinking that I needed another year to get this school off the ground. But, you know, part of me, I'm just, you know, after 10 years of living the life of a school every day, which is about kids and teachers and people and all the rest of it, I can't wait for this planning year to end on some level and just make it be about September again and about kids and teachers and classes and learning. This theory has been great. This has been on some level the sort of most fascinating educational sabbatical on some level that I could have ever imagined this planning year. It's been a chance to sort of immerse my head in theory completely. And then again, sort of going back to practical theory where it's got to be about applying that theory, but I'm kind of ready. I'm ready for September, man.
So, Chris, are you going to be teaching?
I'm going to have an advisory, and if my wife lets me, I'm going to coach at least one sport, because that's the stuff that, you know, at the end of the day, 6:30 in the morning and 12 girls on a basketball court working towards one common goal, or, you know, 20 boys in an ultimate frisbee field, remains the most. I mean, you think I'm excited talking about this stuff, man? You should see, you know, when I coach.
I know the feeling. I coach varsity soccer, and I've been going crazy getting the kids watching World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, at Beacon, just like at SLA, actually, and I swore I would never. You know, Beacon didn't have a gym, so we practiced, and we didn't have field space, as you know, Manhattan, there is none.
Yeah.
So we practiced at 6:30 in the morning for both sports in other people's facilities. And people always used to say to me, you know, how can you wake up and do that? How can you do that? And I would say, come to one practice and see the energy of the kids and tell me how you can't. And we've already started talking about that. We've already got a relationship. You know, I swore I'd never teach in a school with another gym, and yet, you know, here I am founding a school without a gym. And the joys of, you know, of downtown schools, I guess. But we've already talked to a local elementary school about using their gyms in the morning, so you know, so we're ready to do it again.
Do you have any bands?
Yeah, by bands, do you mean music? Two of our teachers, if by bands you mean music, yes. Two of our teachers are classically trained musicians that can't wait to start after-school programs. Eventually, as our faculty grows, I'd like to be able to offer music electives, music theory and stuff. And not only that, but because our kids will be getting maxed, we've got GarageBand right there. So, and we did build a room in the school that is a recording studio. So, they're very much planning on having, you know, music as part of what we do. One of the things I'm waiting for our budget to come through on, so we can make all the sort of peripheral stuff around the technology, is to get our hands on some of those inexpensive MIDIs so kids can start playing around with digital music creation as well as old-fashioned, you know, guitar rock out kind of stuff. You know, the whole piece of the sort of school life is the most difficult piece to plan, interestingly, because that's not about the adults in the building. I mean, sure, on some level, if you've got, you know, a freak like me who loves Ultimate Frisbee and wants to, you know, transfer that love to kids, you know, yeah, we'll have an Ultimate Frisbee team because it's something I'm incredibly passionate about. But we'll only have it if the kids want it. And so, you know, everybody keeps asking us, what after-school activities are you going to have? And the answer is, well, that depends. You know, that depends on the sort of intersection of energy and passion of our students and our teachers. And when kids have said to us, are you going to have this, are you going to have that, our answer to them have been, get 10 like-minded kids together and find a teacher who will sponsor you, and yes, we will find a way to make it happen. You know, and that kind of ownership and that kind of energy and sort of discipline and discipline and passion that you sort of demand of your kids, man, their eyes just get wide and they get excited about the idea, like, man, I get to do that, and that's fun stuff. And again, not every kid. Some kids, you know, when we talk to them about that stuff, go, you know what, I'd rather go to school X that has all of these things already set up and I can just kind of go and be a part of what is, you know, 100 years in tradition, and, you know, and that's real, and that's fair, and that's totally cool. The beautiful thing is we only have 120 spots, so we're not for everybody, and that's okay.
This has been an amazing conversation, Chris. I want to thank you. We're a little bit over an hour, and I don't want to keep you for too much longer, but do you want to sum it up?
Whoa. I mean, I guess, you know, to sum it up is that we're living in an old model in education right now, and hopefully what we're doing, I mean, the funny thing is I think one of the things we're doing is actually taking the best of one of the older theorists out there about public education, and that's John Dewey, and using the technologies in ways to make his vision of that laboratory school come alive in the most powerful ways. I really think that I mean, a lot of the stuff that we talk about, project-based learning, inquiry learning, these are not new ideas, and folks have been trying this stuff for a long time. I mean, the promise of the open classroom of the 70s and the schools without walls and all the rest of it, I think on some level the technologies of our society weren't ready for the pedagogical ideas that were so cutting-edge then. In many respects, I think that what we're doing is applying new technologies to the best of the sort of last 100-plus years of educational thought, and then adding our own spin and adding things that are new. It's like what I wrote in that post. There's a lot of folks out there who are saying that schools no longer have relevance and that the classroom is dead. And, man, the classroom for me is sacred space, always has been. And I think that there's just a lot left there, but we have to change it. We have to change what it means. We've got to make sure that kids understand and have the ability to interact in those spaces in ways that are meaningful and real and authentic and make sense in a changing world. Standing up in the front of the room and giving the kids the facts that they need and, you know, or that you think they need, and then handing them a test where they can bubble in those facts and assuming that's what learning means in 2006 and beyond, it's just not true anymore. But that being said, new ways of thinking, or old ways of thinking and new technologies to apply them, project-based learning, inquiry learning, where kids are judged by the work of their own head, heart, and hands, man, there's no limit to what we can do. And, I can't believe that I've had the opportunity to do this. I can't believe that I've managed to find folks who are like-minded and excited about it. And I can't believe the overwhelming energy and passion we've seen from our students and parents to go on this journey with us. And, excitement, words can't describe how excited I am, how exciting this has been, and how far I think we can go.
Wow, that's Chris, an impressive summary, Chris. Thanks.
you are inspirational.
I can listen to that over and over. I just want to thank you again also for coming in. I mean, I've been reading your blog after Alex showed it to me. It's great to get to ask you questions in person. I think a lot of people are going to be following you closely and wishing you guys the best. I know I am.
Thank you.
If you're not reading Chris's blog, make sure you check it out, practicaltheory.org. And we talked about a lot of resources today, which we will post all of them on our show wiki, which is agar-webcast.wikispaces.com. And
everything will be linked from edtechtalk.com, from that blog.
Yes.
And we're also going to be encouraging folks to comment on that blog. So if you have questions or comments, please post away, as well as the new audio blog on EdTechTalk. Dave Cormier and Jeff Lebo got that go. So you can actually leave an audio message at edtechtalk.com. And I want to thank Chris again and Arvind. And I guess this is the end of our webcast number 6, the 21st Century Learning webcast with Alex Ragone and Arvind Groven on the EdTechTalk channel of the World Bridges Network.